This is the first trailer of the Locked Up Living podcast, which Naomi Murphy and David Jones are launching in January 2021. This podcast focuses on resilience in individuals and in challenging organisations such as prisons and hospitals. We're interviewing a wide range of people with lived and professional experience, but thought you should know something about us first. When you get to the end, you will hear our theme tune, You Have Called Me Courage, which Pete and Rach have kindly allowed us to use. You can find it on Spotify.
So, David, I was listening back to this conversation to see how it went, and obviously picked up on the fact that we both slip up and use the word offender in here, which I thought was really interesting because it's a word that I rarely use, and I'm guessing I've used that as a way to try and encompass people that come into contact with the criminal justice system. But it actually really jarred because I don't think it's a very helpful word to use. And we did have a conversation about whether we edit it out. But I think we both decided it was important to keep it in. If we didn't use it, I think people wouldn't necessarily know that we were consciously not using it, and so may not even notice that the word doesn't get used. One of the things that really jars certainly in the prison system is the kind of language that gets used about people in prison, that really can be quite dehumanizing or pins them into a box that then becomes hard to come out from. So the kind of language I mean is use of words like feeding for mealtimes and shipping people out. And both of those words conjure up the image of cattle to me. And they jarred when I first started working in prisons, and they still jar to this day. And I think we both felt it would be useful to keep in this use of the word offender in here in order to make mention of the fact that actually our language is important, and the language we use might restrict people's options and create a framework for viewing people that's actually really unhelpful. So apologies to anyone who's listening who also has a jarring response to our use of this word. And I think it's important that people know that we want this to be a learning process, and this podcast to be informative and educative. And I think we are not going to achieve that if we edit out any of the things that make us uncomfortable, when in fact sometimes learning is deeply uncomfortable, and it feels more important on balance, I think, to keep this word in on this occasion.
Hello, my name's David Jones, and I'm sitting here with
Naomi Murphy,
and we are jointly launching the Locked Up Living podcast. And we thought it'd be useful to have a bit of a conversation between ourselves and to describe a bit of our experience and our background. Would you like to start with that, Naomi?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist and currently the clinical director of the FEN service at HMP Whitemore. And that's a specialist trauma-focused service for men in our high-secure prison. And how about you?
Yes, well, I was thinking about what to say about myself, because my experience goes back quite a long way, really. And I was thinking about a paper. There was a paper written by somebody called Elliot Jacks in the mid-60s, I think, called Death and the Midlife Crisis, which was obviously about the midlife crisis. But the thing that he highlighted in that was the idea that people work through things over an extended period of their life. And he was referring specifically to creative people. Well, I'm not particularly wanting to describe myself as a creative person, but I think it's certainly true that I've worked on and through various similar themes throughout my life. So to begin, I started working with homeless men in a shelter. After that, I trained as a social worker, and then I worked in psychiatric hospitals. And at that time, there were no forensic units. There were general adult psychiatric units. And according to who your consultant psychiatrist was, you had a greater or lesser interest in working with people who had offended. And I happened to work in a unit which was both a therapeutic community and took a special interest in working with offenders. So in a way, that was the second stage of that sort of working through. And then about 35 years ago, I trained as a psychotherapist. And since then, I've been working in various settings, primarily with offenders in prisons, so Grendon Prison, Gartree Prison, and the Millfields unit in East London, all with offenders. I've been working through the same kind of themes in my own life throughout that time, I think. I haven't quite got to the end yet.
We can kind of see that, because I guess even in working with the population of homelessness, you often see offending creeps in there as well, doesn't it? Even if it's by virtue of circumstances. And then, as you say, working in a psychiatric service, but often, I guess, groups who, for whatever reasons, do not attract as many people to want to work with these populations, do they? It's harder to get people to see them as being worthy of care and nurturance. And it's interesting that actually you have clearly seen that throughout over a very long period.
Yes, certainly it's true that I spent a lot of my time in going to court with men when I was working with in the homeless shelter, and often they were men who were seriously disadvantaged and unwell, with the exception of one man I can think of very clearly, who I would later, I suppose, have described as being a charming but dangerous psychopath. I think almost entirely the men were quite disabled. But tell me about your experience, because you've been at the Fens for a long time, haven't you?
I have, but I suppose after I graduated, my very first kind of like proper job, if you like, was working in a prison as a trainee prison psychologist. Up around Doncaster, and I suppose in that role, feeling very ill-equipped for the work, because working there, it just seemed really obvious to me that everybody, all the individuals that I spoke to, had actually had quite a lot of challenges early on in life, and I was left feeling that actually what they really needed was someone with the skills to be able to engage them in understanding how that early childhood experience has contributed to where they were at the moment. So I then went and trained as a clinical psychologist after only about 9 months working as a prison psychologist, and chose to do my final year placement at in a medium secure unit at Stockton Hall. And I think what was interesting is I went there choosing to not go and do a group work placement, because I was a bit frightened of doing group work, and actually ended up doing a lot of group work in a specialist service for people, again, people with personality disorders. And knowing at the time, like the phrase personality disorder really got my heckles up. I felt that it was a really horrible label. But I suppose while I was there, I could see that actually if people could be identified as having some recognisable disorder, it meant that they then got access to a service that otherwise they'd have been denied access to. They'd have just been seen as being very difficult. So whilst I really disliked the label, I was prepared to work with that, thinking that at least I'm doing the job of providing some care to people who ordinarily, you know, would not be people who would be attracting care. Therefore, 4 years post-qualification, stayed there after I got my doctorate, and then was involved in setting up the very first InReach team into Leeds Prison. And most of the work there ended up being in the segregation unit at Leeds Prison, really working with the sort of the more challenging individuals in the prison before going to work at Whitemore 17 years ago. Mm. But again, I suppose I've always enjoyed working with offenders. I suppose I liked the challenge. And I think quite often psychologists gravitate towards working with people that are quite easy to establish relationships with. And in having been in placements in different services, seen that quite often psychologists would cherry pick who they'd work with. They'd work with the people who were the more psychologically minded, the more reflective. And yet our training is more extensive. Quite often we're better paid members of the team. And it didn't really feel right that some of the other disciplines were then having to pick people up who were perhaps less equipped to in terms of the training that they had. And I suppose I felt like everyone should have the right to have good psychological care. And actually, if people aren't easily getting into services, it's my job as a service provider to try and find a way to make the service more accessible, rather than saying to the individual, you're not good enough to come into this service, which is what the message often felt like for services.
So you took that kind of approach, that kind of attitude with you into the Fens. How was it that the culture and the approach at the Fens developed?
Yeah, that's a good question. I suppose in some ways when we worked, because I worked at Stockton Hall with Des McVeigh, was the ward manager there, and together we developed a treatment programme that drew on, so there was already group analysis work in situ there, which was obviously really valuable, but then also it felt like for some people they need a bit more kind of like structured intervention, so introducing schema-focused therapy. So when we went to the Fens unit, which at the time was the first pilot project for the Dangerous and Severe Personality Disorder project, which again, a really horrible label, but actually, and attracted a lot of flack at the time, but actually I think the motivation behind the project was a really good one. It was about providing treatment to people who'd been excluded from treatment. And that's what really appealed to me, was that we were going to be starting a service for men who basically had nothing. They were stuck in the prison system. They were seen as being a management problem and didn't have any opportunities to work forward, because they were either excluded from treatment because of their psychopathy scores, or they were too challenging in terms of their behaviour. So went to the DSPD service at Whitemore, and the very first month I started there, my boss, the clinical director, resigned and went on gardening leave. So left with kind of like having to create a treatment program, which had to be approved by a panel of, I think, 10 professors of psychology and psychiatry who were considered to be experts in personality disorder, and present them with a treatment program that was seen as being acceptable. And that was done in conjunction with Des McVeigh, and was very much about, it is our job to try and create a service for people who don't have another avenue for treatment within the prison service. So we set, it was basically intended for people who'd been labelled as untreatable. And we knew from our own experience previously that the reasons that people are considered untreatable is often about their difficulties trusting in authority figures, the people that are offering them help and support. And I think too often as psychologists, therapists, caregivers, we assume that because our job role is about care, we assume that we'll be taken in that way. But in fact, if the people who should have been looking after you and providing you with care during childhood were abusing you or neglecting you, why would someone who's paid to be a carer do a better job of that in adulthood? And really putting ourselves in the shoes, I guess, of those individuals and trying to understand what are the barriers to trust and building relationships.
That's really interesting. There are a couple of things that struck me there. Talking about accreditation, the accreditation for your panel takes me right back 20 years, I suppose, when the accreditation panel was staffed by pretty hardline behaviourists and CBT addicts. And there was actually a written requirement that the programme had to just be a CBT programme. And I think by the time that the DSPD programme, and I suppose that later became the PD pathway, didn't it? The personality disorder pathway. By the time that had come round, they'd managed to kind of modify that approach by the accreditation panel so that things like the FENS programme, the Grendon TC programme could finally be accredited.
Well, that's interesting, because actually Grendon did manage to get accredited. We've never tried to be accredited, but I think we benefited from Grendon being something different that followed a different course, if you like. We didn't seek accreditation at all, but in some ways that was a challenge, because people were so used to this model of accreditation within the prison system. And obviously the model of accreditation is about the quality of the treatment that's delivered. It's not about the individual at the end, but obviously prisoners at times are seen as being, it's almost as if they're accredited themselves if they participate in treatment. So I think it's interesting, because I think Grendon shook things up a bit by not offering treatment in the manualised way, which is the easier way to gain accreditation, I guess, when you're doing something where everyone can see what's happening from week to week. Whereas, you know, human beings are much more fluid in their interactions, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I think we should be grateful to Dr. Mark Morris and John Shine, who put in a tremendous amount of work into those early accreditation efforts. So, you're reminding me now that we began to have a conversation about this podcast because we both realised that we'd worked in organisations, perhaps that's not quite the right word, in establishments, in cultures that had been going for a long time, and where people had carried, you know, the memories of their participation in those cultures, those treatment programs, but somehow these establishments had a long life. And then we talked about the Barlinnie unit up in Scotland, even though it had been closed some 25, 26 years ago, it's still remembered. They still have exhibitions in memory of that unit. Grendon has been going some 60 years. Dovegate has been going almost 20 years. So there's something about these establishments which make a real impact upon people's lives and upon the kind of general culture. And that's how we got talking about starting this podcast, as I remember it.
Yes, it is. And I think one of the things we were reflecting on was that actually working in these harsh places can kind of bring out the cynicism in people. And, you know, one of the things that made me really want to do this podcast with you is about the fact that it hasn't left you jaded and cynical. And I think it takes something to hold on to the kind of like the more wholesome part of your personality in working in these places. But also that I think we've both been followed and been quite interested in these different units, these specialist units, which have worked really hard to try and offer a different culture, something that's quite countercultural to the what's available in prisons generally. And I do believe there is a wish at a higher level for all prisons to offer something that really is therapeutically useful and meaningful. And offer something more caring. But I think quite often there are challenges that make that harder when you're looking at that whole on a whole scale way, whereas I think in discrete units it's been possible to do that. And I think this, I was interested in exploring with you how those, how some units do manage to create these pockets of nurturing, caring, compassionate spaces, and manage to sustain that despite, you know, there's a lot of harshness, you know, in terms of the information and knowledge that people are exposed to, the strength of feeling, you know, being met with feelings of hatred and anger when you're working in prisons and other secure settings, and how you hold on to being compassionate in the face of that. And I think we're both quite keen to explore that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we were determined really to carry out some kind of investigation to try and establish what are the features, what are the characteristics, what are the dynamics of these establishments which can provide a positive and developing culture and which can build upon and sustain the resilience of staff and of the residents that we've been working with.
Yeah, and I think also, I suppose I'm curious about, I suppose what makes people want to work in forensic units, and is that drive that makes people want to work in, it's that joke, isn't it, that people always study the area that's most pertinent to them in some way. It was interesting you started with a reference to death and the midlife crisis, and I was curious about what you thought might have attracted you to forensic work, what your motivation had been.
Well, that's a really good question, which of course I've been asked and have asked myself many times, and I've never come up with a particularly good answer, I don't think. And I think one of the things I've been doing recently is looking into my own background, and that's been fascinating because I found connections with the army in India, with an Indian woman who one of my ancestors begat a child with, so that led to them coming back and living in the East End of London. I discovered that my family going back several centuries have all lived in the East End of London, or the North East, so areas, as it happens, of major change and deprivation. So I've got a kind of sympathetic link with underprivileged people, which sounds terribly twee, I think, but nevertheless, it's there. But the other thing that I discovered I really enjoyed was working with people in a completely open and honest way. And when you're working with offenders in the way that I've chosen to, which has been almost entirely in therapeutic communities, the expectation is, and the pressure is, to be open and honest, because you want people to be open and honest with you. And I found that enormously refreshing years ago, and I still do.
Yeah, and I've often wondered whether some of that, because I agree with you, I think in forensic it's essential to be open and honest and quite straight talking. And I suppose my dad was in the forces, so he moved around a lot, but often living in quite male dominated cultures. And I think it's often seemed as though amongst groups of men, there's a more direct way of communicating that's just cut into the chase and just saying what's going on, which I think is really valuable in working with offenders rather than kind of like hinting at. Because I think actually for people who've spent a lot of time having to second guess what's going on in order to survive childhood, the population often finds it much easier if you're just straight down the line and talk directly. And I suppose for me, I think there's a comfort about that rather than having to hedge and second guess what else might be going on. And I think that's quite refreshing, that's being able to just talk directly to the point. But I have wondered whether how much of that is about kind of like gender and stereotyped masculinity, or how much of that is about forensic settings?
Yeah, that's interesting, those comments, because I've spent most of my life trying to avoid being in those kind of archetypal masculine situations. I've always found them to make me extremely uneasy. But of course, having said that, you know, being in a male prison is an extremely kind of macho, you know, kind of setting, I think.
Absolutely. I was just thinking that you haven't done a very good job of avoiding testosterone and machismo.
No.
So, but I suppose also, you know, the other question that I'd really wanted to ask you, David, was, you know, actually you've been around in forensic, you know, challenging environments for a very long time. And I wondered what sustained you over that, you know, what are your survival strategies? What's helped you cope with that and still enjoy and embrace opportunities to work with within these really quite harsh settings?
Yes. I think what I found is that life consists of peaks and troughs. So in my work, I've had times of great exhilaration where I felt we've really made major steps in, say, developing a culture or helping a particular individual, working with particular groups and individuals of staff, and then they can be followed often quite quickly by a realization that things are just awful. I've made terrible mistakes in something I've said or something I've done, and I had to kind of work my way through that. And the way that I've worked my way through it is I've always had great opportunities for supervision and going and talking to people about the challenges that I've encountered. And so that's been a great source of inspiration. And I've always had a very rich kind of life of, well, I suppose in the last 30 years of discovering opera. And opera is another one of those things which has extraordinary peaks and troughs. So if you go to an opera, say if you go to see Tristan and Isolde, which is a Wagner opera, then you may have 5 hours of what seems like really quite demanding and sometimes turgid music, but the final 10 minutes make it all worthwhile. So I always found that a very refreshing kind of hobby, I suppose.
That sounds a little bit like a more, perhaps more cerebral version of, you know, the approach to going to the gym and that no pain, no gain, that you need
yes,
the painful parts to experience the pleasurable parts.
Well, I have tried gyms in the past, but I've never got to the point where I've got much enjoyment out of it. I never got that buzz that people talk about. I probably didn't try hard enough. How about you? What sustains you?
I wonder whether there's something about, I suppose I'm quite an intense person and I like close relationships. And I suppose one of the features that comes alongside working in forensic settings is when there's that kind of like risk and danger that people bond through adversity, don't they? And that actually, if you're facing a shared problem together, it kind of like brings people closer. And in all the services that I've worked in, I felt that we've managed to really create a strong sense of community. And that, you know, that community has included not just the staff, but also the clients, whether that be patients or prisoners. And so I suppose you end up with these deep connections with people that actually then you don't want to get away from, because actually there's something quite rich about those. And I suppose also I've enjoyed the challenge. So I feel I've constantly learned about myself and grown through some of the challenges. So that's the same direction, that directiveness that's required in conversation. I think I've also had very direct feedback from service users about how people have experienced me, and that being important to take on board that feedback and constructive criticism, even if it hasn't always felt as if it's been delivered in a way that's perhaps packaged as so constructive. So, but I've enjoyed that. And then I think also in working with more challenging populations, because CBT, as usual, doesn't work, there's been a willingness to explore some kind of like different ways of working. And I suppose that keeps you on your toes. It means you have to keep learning and looking at what's out there, constantly thinking, how can we broaden who we can make this service accessible to? Because, I really don't like to think that people are prevented from growing through psychological therapy because the service sees them as being not good enough for the service. And I think in many mainstream services for adults, you're expected to deliver a treatment as usual, which is often quite limited. And I like the fact that in forensic services, there's the possibility to look at doing something different because there's a recognition that group hasn't been helped by treatment as usual. And the reality is we are human beings and we're all gonna have different things that offer us nurturance or hope, and we're not all the same. And I like that recognition of idiosyncratic differences and the ability to be a little bit more free thinking, I think.
I was thinking where you were talking that it was a bit more personal information, really, that a couple of things came to mind. One was I spent a lot of time visiting approved premises, or I did before the pandemic, all over the country, places in the country I've never dreamt that I'd go to. And I went to one in Windsor. This must be 2 years ago, so 2018. And I met there a middle-aged man now, who I'd met as a young man in Grendon. So in the early part of the century, so 17 years ago, that made me enormously sad because he wasn't a horrible young man. He was somewhat rigid and autistic, and he'd spent years at Grendon and then years and years more in the prison system, and then was released into an approved premises where he was going to be discharged with nowhere to live. And that really upset me. I thought this is a terrible way for someone to be treated. So that was one example. And another example was I went somewhere else and met a young man who'd just been released from Gartry. So I'd known at Gartry relatively recently. And I was really pleased to see him. He was doing extremely well. The team there really liked him and were fully supportive of him. And I felt really good after that encounter. So I have real problems with much of our criminal justice service. And earlier on, you said that you thought that most of the senior managers in the prison services wanted to create positive environments for prisoners. And I agree, I think that's true. But I think there are other dynamics, other forces at work to do with fear, anxiety, the concern about being blamed and being made responsible and sacked for doing things which go wrong. And there are terrible things which occur or get told in the press, which make everybody scared of being caught out and doing things which they may be embarrassed or humiliated for. And I think those dynamics, those forces are at play. And I hope that at some stage in our podcast history, we'll be able to think about those and how they can be approached and tackled.
Yeah, I think that's a really good challenge for us. I think that idea of finding ways to explore the making of mistakes, and because you see that sometimes that people, no one's perfect, we all make mistakes, and actually trying to conceal a mistake actually leaves you way more vulnerable in a public sector position, and it would be so good to have a little bit more compassion extended when people do make mistakes, and trying to find a way to learn from that rather than just respond in the punitive way that I think society kind of like deals with people who break the law, you know. And it never fails to shock me when they show you some kind of like poll about how many people believe in bringing back the death penalty. And I think that punitive drive is very reflective, you know, that's a pressure that is there within the system as well.
Yeah. So thinking about our podcast, we're going to be interviewing a lot of very interesting people with a wide range of experience. And we're going to be focusing, at least at the beginning, on establishing those positive features. Is that the way you see it?
Yes, I think so. I'd really like us to be able to highlight some of the really good practice that happens. And also, I would like I don't want the podcast to be a doom fest. I would really like the podcast to be something that's kind of hopeful and inspirational. But I do think it would be important to explore what some of those barriers to resilience and well-being are, because I think they are we're talking about particularly challenging settings. So I would like us to be able to explore those barriers, and also really want to hear from a broad range of people. I mean, quite often psychological services are delivered by white middle class, often women, more often probably women than men, and really want to hear from a broader range of voices. Really like to hear more people of colour, and also have a lived experience perspective on things, because I truly believe that we're better the more diverse the perspectives we hear on stuff. So really looking forward to learning myself. I mean, that's partly what was really appealing to me about this. Is a challenge for me as a bit of an introvert, but really hoping to learn more from hearing different people's perspectives as time goes on.
Good. Well, that's our manifesto, really, isn't it? So
I think so, David. So yeah, excited to be embarking on this, and yeah, looking forward to all the interesting people that we've got lined up.
Exactly.
I'm sure people are going to love to hear more from.